Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, hello, Beatle fans. It's been so long, and, you know, we've all been so busy with things that we really didn't want to be busy with COVID and a pandemic going on. Busy being not busy, but I'm happy to be back again, and we have a brand new guest for you. This week's guest is Jay Mark. He's originally from Atlantic City, and he's currently in New York. I'm not sure where, but we'll just call it New York. Hi, Jay. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Good. So you are originally from Atlantic City, right?
Yeah, you'll probably pick up some of my Jersey accent during this conversation. I never totally got rid of it.
Yeah. I spent you know, about 11 years growing up in New Jersey as a kid, so I always say I have a vocabulary like of, you know, a native New Jersey person. I try to keep it under wraps a lot of the time. anyway, so Atlantic City back in the 60s wasn't what was that like?
I mean, it was great in the wintertime. Well, first of all, my parents moved there from Philadelphia when I was 2 years old. And I guess because they liked the beach. My mother was a real beach fanatic. We had a roomy house there. People came and stayed with us during the summer. But in the wintertime, we had the city to ourselves, me and my friends. You know, it was just a regular, like, small town, 65,000 people, something like that. In the summertime, you know, maybe a million or so showed up, and it was a party, you know. So it was just a great city. It was nothing like it is now. It was a regular small town community, more or less, you know, homes, stores, shops, but no real industrialization or anything like that. You know, there were the funds that were necessary to keep the city running came from it being a resort. So those 3 months a year when people came there to, you know, celebrate the summer, that's when the city got its income that kept us going for the rest of the year. And, of course, everybody knows that. After the advent of the popularity of Vegas and Disneyland, Atlantic City was desperate to find some way to make money, and that's how the casinos came in. But I was long gone by the time that happened.
Yeah, yeah. So it was. So when you lived there, it was still in its, you know, beautiful resort town.
Yes.
Kind of. I want to say kind of that Cape May kind of feeling. I would assume the kind of New Jersey Shore.
Wildwood, Cape May, you know, there's typical Jersey Shore communities. But the Atlantic City happened to be famous. You know, it was the world's famous playground. And I guess that all happened in the maybe the 30s and 40s, 50s. I know growing up, there was always something to do. Steel Pier, you go for 65 cents. You could spend the whole day on Steel Pier and see two movies, first-run movies, see live bands, and go on rides and stuff. It was great. It was really a great place to grow up. I have no bad vibes about it at all in hindsight.
So you ended up, you graduated from, I guess, Atlantic City High School it would be, or something, you know.
Yeah.
And you ended up, did you go to college?
For 6 months. When I got out of high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, who knows what they want to do at like 16 or 17 years old. So
right.
I had a hobby in electronics. And so I said, all right, maybe I'll be an electrical engineer. So I went to Drexel. I actually got a scholarship. I went to Drexel, but 6 months in, I totally lost interest in school. They had a computer there. It was one of the earliest IBM computers that totally fascinated me. And I wound up cutting all my classes and hanging out at the computing center. So I just eventually left school. I was only there like 6 months. So I am an uneducated person in some respects.
So, but you ended up with a job at Convention Hall in
Atlantic
City.
Right.
Yeah. Now, how did you stumble upon this? How did you get this?
You know, I don't remember exactly how it happened. I must have been looking for work, and somebody said something to somebody. I don't know. I really can't remember. But I was interviewed, and I got hired. And I wound up working there for like 2 or 3 years. I did three Miss America pageants, you know, and of course the, in 64, the Beatles were there and the Democratic Convention and a Miss America pageant all in the space of a month. So,
wow.
But I don't remember. Somebody must have said something to my parents about there's a job opening. I don't know. I really don't remember. But
mm-hmm.
I got in, and I was there for a few years.
Yeah. How old were you?
22 at the time the Beatles were there.
Yeah. I mean, weren't you – and you were a soundman. You were working in the sound department, right?
Yeah. I was originally just hired as a sound guy. There was about a half a dozen of us. I was the youngest, and then for some reason, which again, I don't remember the details, my boss, after about 3 or 4 months, made me a supervisor. So I was a supervisor over these other folks, but I swear to you, I never remember supervising anything. You know, I would come to work, and my boss would say, okay, here's what's happening today. You do this room, you know, you do that room, you know, that was it.
Maybe they were just trying to get the kid to get up early and open the doors, you know, and do all the hard work while they slept late and could come in and you have everything set up. Who knows, you know, because, you know, it's amazing because that's a job, you know, in this day and age, you'd have to be well trained to do. You don't just walk into, you know, a convention center or convention hall or any kind of theater and, you know, oh, I'd like to be a sound man, you know. Work in your sound department.
Well,
so,
I'm guessing, I don't remember exactly, but I'm guessing that the first few months they just had me running cables and stuff like that. And then mm-hmm. they put me behind a console at some point and found out that I could do the job. I have to plead the vagueness of memory for the specifics of those days, but my mind tends to work like that in general. Some things stick and some don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also at the time, who's to say, you know, that we'll ever have to recall those memories, you know? But the fact is that you were there August 30th, 1964, when the Beatles played. What do you recall about that day? I mean,
well,
leading up to it,
mind.
I mean, was it just a nightmare scene around Atlantic City, around the hall, around, you know, screaming girls?
Well, I mean, my world was not that world. I was in my 20s already. I was not really caught up in the Beatles fad at the time. In fact, prior to doing that gig, I only had a passive interest in them. You know, it was just another gig.
Right.
But what actually happened was they blew me away that night, and I've been a fan ever since. And I was probably one of the few people in the whole room. There was like 30,000 people there. Who could hear them, because I was in a soundproof booth on the side of the stage. So, sorry, folks, if you missed it, I got it for you.
Was it recorded?
A recording was made somewhere along the line, because it's online. So I'm not clear exactly how that happened, but...
But you weren't
fact,
it.
No.
You weren't the one recording it.
No, that was not me. Mm-hmm. I don't know who, I mean, it could have been anybody who was there if they had access to our audio feed, but somehow it emerged. But I always did feel kind of bad that nobody could hear anything probably but me, maybe the people in the front first few rows. But the sound system there was designed for regular conventions. So at that time, just stop me if I'm going into too much detail. That
no,
room,
you're never.
Hall,
there's never too much detail. Never too much.
Okay, well, for the miracle of editing, you can make it as detailed as you want. But anyway, that room was the largest indoor arena with an unobstructed view. In other words, there was no poles from beginning to end. It was all self-supporting. It was almost a block long and a block wide. And we also had the world's largest organ at that time, which had 64,000 pipes. And when the low notes played, the whole building shook. It was fantastic. So what was the question? Oh, so it was about me hearing that. Anyway, so when the concert started, everybody started screaming, of course, and you couldn't really hear yourself think out on the floor. That's what really blew me away about them. This was long before the era of stage monitors or anything like that. We didn't even have the instruments mic'd. They had their amps, Ringo on the drums, and there was only vocal mics. There was a vocal mic on Ringo, one vocal on John, and another one that was shared by Paul and George.
George. Mm-hmm.
That was it. Three microphones. Can you imagine? So
yeah.
And they were totally in tune, on time. There's one. There was a part in one song, I think it was And I Love Her, where somebody, they sang the wrong words. John and Paul accidentally sang, one sang the first verse and one sang the second verse at the same time. You can hear it in the tape. But, man, I'm telling you, they really knocked me out. And so I've been a diehard fan ever since.
Wow. So what was your job over in the booth?
Well, I was the guy who ran the board. You know, I was the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I mean, there wasn't that much work to do. This was a gig with three microphones. That doesn't take a genius to set up. So we set up the mics, and I go in the booth. You know, we have our monitors in there. But that room had a movable booth. It was on wheels. I would say it was mm-hmm. about 8 feet by 8 feet, maybe 10 by 10. And
mm-hmm.
we had a console in there and the power amps and so forth. But it was soundproof. So during the conventions, the operator would be in there. And the only time he would really get to hear what was going on outside was if he opened the door and stuck his head out, okay? And but being in the booth, if there was ever any feedback or anything, you would hear it right away, the same as they would hear it outside, because it would feed back through the microphone. So that was never an issue.
I can only imagine the group of you in this booth and knowing that screaming is going on and no one is ever going to dare open that door.
It wasn't exactly like that. First of all, there was no group. It was me and my boss. And
okay.
And maybe there might've been one other person that was traveling with the Beatles that might've been in there. And I don't remember. It was very low key, you know, it was just another gig. Me and my boss and whoever the Beatles rep was, I think there was somebody in there from there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like people would come along and open the door or anything. We were on the stage with them, and that was it. And there were also two, as I recall, there were two opening acts, but I cannot remember. I thought it was Jackie DeShannon and Stevie Wonder. But I've never been able to get confirmation of anybody on who the opening acts were. I'm sure about Jackie DeShannon. I'm not sure about Stevie Wonder. So this is my hazy memory.
Mm-hmm. So did you have a good view to watch them?
Well, sure. It was right on the side of the stage. The stage was maybe 60 feet wide. And we were, on stage right about, 10 feet away from the edge of the stage. So I was maybe 20 feet away from them. But, yeah.
So you had the best seats in the house, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, the people in the first rows, I mean, probably the only people who really had a good shot at them were the people in the first few rows, because as soon as they started singing, everybody got up and stood on their chairs and were going nuts. You know, but the scream was the thing. You can't even imagine, unless you were there, what it was like to hear this constant scream for a half hour. Unbelievable. And, they were pretty good. Pretty good little band, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. So there's a picture that we're sharing with everybody who's listening on the little slide show that we have of pictures of you. And there's a picture of you in the off to, well, I guess behind them. They're all standing.
Right.
Well, two are sitting, two are standing. Is that the press conference?
Right.
Was it prior to that?
Yeah, we did a news conference before the show. There was actually another picture that was taken of just me and them, the four of them at a table and me on the side with my little console. But I gave that picture to somebody I was dating, and I don't know, it disappeared. But I was lucky to even get this one because it just so happened that I don't remember how long it was after the gig, but I was dating a woman who was a model, and she had been voted Miss New Jersey State Fair at some point. Well,
mm-hmm.
the guy that sponsored the Jersey State Fair was named George Hammett. He also owned Steel Pier, and he was the guy who also brought the Beatles in. So my girlfriend happened to be in his office one day and saw those pictures of me on his wall and said, oh, wow, it's my boyfriend. Can I have those pictures? And that's how I happened to have them, because otherwise I would have no, visual representation of the incident at all. It's just by luck I got those pictures.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it was a fluke, a total fluke.
Yeah. So what's it like attending a press conference? A Beatles press? Is it? I mean,
well,
obviously, it's not the screaming mayhem that.
Well, you can see by looking at the picture, there's just a mob of photographers totally surrounding them. And then they're there at their little table. And behind them was George Hammond and me and maybe one or two other people. Not a big room, small room, maybe held 50 people in there. But, you know, they were who they were. So they were big news, and there was news media from all over the world there and they followed their whole tour. It was pretty – it's a shame we don't have a tape of that because, you know, they're very jovial guys. They're real smart asses, you know, and they were had great answers for all the stupid questions that were being asked of them. Like, you can imagine Bob Dylan having a news conference, the same kind of thing, you know. You get asked all these silly, insipid questions that are just – it's just like people doing their gig, you know. That it's not a problem, mm-hmm. but it's nothing that where you would think you would ever learn anything that mattered in an environment like that. It was fun. The whole thing was great. I am really glad that those couple of pictures got taken and even that the thing got recorded because it was a good concert.
Quite memorable. I can only imagine, you know, that you don't even realize, you know, as you said, you weren't a regular fan and, you know, just a casual fan, if that, and suddenly there you are, you know, in the middle of this and standing, you know, 6 feet away from, you know, the biggest band the world has ever known. And it's quite a story. But you actually went on. Were you a musician prior to meeting them?
I'm not really a musician. I play guitar a little bit, but not so you'd call me a musician. It's a hobby. That had nothing to do with the Beatles.
I didn't know if they inspired you, because a lot of people come, you know, say, oh, well, that's the reason I picked up a guitar.
No,
the Beatles.
In my case, there was no connection there.
No connection. But you went on, you continued on with a career in recording.
Well, first I had a radio career. I was a disc jockey for 10 years, first in Atlantic City and then in Philadelphia. And I still have a little bit of a Philly accent, too, I'm sure. But I went, radio, audio was a hobby of mine all, my whole life. And it just so happened that one of my early gigs was at Convention Hall. But then I also was on the radio in Atlantic City, a station called WMID. And mm-hmm. from there, I went to WDAS-FM in Philadelphia, which was the first underground rock station on the East Coast. So, I mean, it was pretty good. I had my little artistic fingers dipped in various pots over the course of my life. But then after 10 mm-hmm. years in radio, I really wasn't into it. I couldn't see it as a permanent pursuit. But I had been interested in recording because I had been able to go to a recording session at one point when I was still on the air on the radio, and I was just blown away by the sound and the equipment. So when this is a little bit of diversion away from the Beatles, but I won't stay long. So I was working.
I want to talk about your career because, you know, and we'll get into this. I mean, you've had quite the career. I mean, you know, you started out, you know, as the kid in the sound booth at you know, a Beatles concert, and ended up with a career in recording, which is still within the music industry. And, you know, I think the readers or listeners would be, you know, find this really fascinating what you've done since.
Well, depending on your level, your threshold of boredom, if you're interested, fine. You know, each his own.
Yeah.
But the short story is I went from Convention Hall into radio. I was a disc jockey for 10 years, the last couple of years in Philadelphia. And the station I was working at, I just mentioned, they changed their format. So everybody left our station and went to our competitor, which was called WMMR. And they're still there. I said this is enough radio for me, let me see if I can get into recording. And then I just started hanging around the only studio I knew about in Philadelphia, which was called Sigma Sound. They needed mm-hmm. somebody to help wire up a new console, and because I knew how to solder, I got hired. And then I went from there to being an assistant, then an engineer, and then, like, you know, then retired.
Now also in our slideshow of pictures, I found on your website a picture of you at the board with Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
Now, is that a picture? Were you in the were you there for a recording for him? Is that what's? I mean, when was this?
I would say the early 70s. Yeah, I was the engineer. Well, like I alluded to a moment ago, I got a job at Sigma Sound. After the console was built, they let me become an assistant. And after a year of that, they made me an engineer. And I worked with some great people. Stevie was one of them. Paul Williams, I did an album with him. I did a lot of stuff with Gamble and Huff, you know, the OJs and Billy Paul and people like that. And then there was stuff with Madonna. You know, Madonna I only worked with as a mixer. And toward the end of my recording career, and oh, I forgot to tell you, I started in Philadelphia, but in 1978, my boss asked me if I would be willing to move to New York to manage the new New York studio. So that's how I wound up in New York, where I still am. And then once I moved to New York, I had a reputation by that time. Man, you guys falling asleep, just slap yourselves. You know, I don't want to bore you to death.
No, nobody's going to fall asleep for this story.
All right. Well, while I was in Philadelphia, I more or less gravitated into doing dance mixes with this guy named Tom Moulton. He's the guy that invented disco mixes, okay, where you would take a regular song and stretch it out into 4 hours with drum breaks and stuff. So I did a lot of dance mixes with him. And once I got to New York, I still had that reputation, so I got hired to do some of the other stuff, and that's how come I wound up with Madonna and some of the people in New York. And in the later stages of my career, I worked with Talking Heads. I did some stuff with them. And the last project stuff I did was in the 90s with the Allman Brothers. I did 6 albums with them. And then somehow I went from there into TV audio, and then I spent a few years doing that.
Right, and just to mention, because, you know, we were talking about it before we started recording, was how many years did you spend working at The View, doing the sound for The View, the TV show?
I'd say at least 4. It might have been more, but what happened at The View was, after a while, they needed somebody to work on the weekend Good Morning America. You know, Good Morning America was originally only a 5-day-a-week show, weekday show. And then they started doing it on the weekends, and they needed somebody to do audio there. So they asked me if I was interested. I said, yeah, I'm interested. So I was working at The View 4 days a week, and then I was working at Good Morning America on the weekends. And then there was this big furor because, oh, my God, the guy's working 6 days a week. We got to pay him overtime. You know, some kind of crazy nonsense like that. So it was very strange. There was some political stuff involved. And in the end, somebody who knew more than me said, you know, you really should make a choice between whether you want to work it here, meaning The View, or GMA on the weekends, because it looks like you're not going to be able to do both. And he said, I'll tell you the truth. I think you should take the weekend gig. So that's what I did. I wound up doing a weekend gig for maybe 8 years, you know, working 2 days a week. It was fun. I mean, I had a run of different kinds of things to do, and they were all fun and informative and educating and educational in their own right. So, yeah, talking about it now, sounds like I was a busy guy, but I guess I was. But, yeah, I did, from out of nowhere, I managed to do all this stuff, you know, with no formal training in anything. So I guess luck had something to do with it. I guess there was some degree of talent or ability that kept me in once I got in.
Yeah, and you're a lucky guy, because a lot of, you know, you got in at the right time. You got into the sound business when, you know, you could just walk in as a kid, you know, and grow into the job. It's a dream job that so many people would love to have had. I mean, and just imagine what people would have given to be the guy in the booth who could actually hear the Beatles in Atlantic City during the concert. I mean, you know, you're from Philadelphia, or you've worked in Philadelphia as a radio DJ, and I don't know if you might know T. Morgan.
Yeah, sure. He worked with me at DAS. It was him, right. Michael Pearson, Ed Shockey, T. Steve Morgan, me, Steve Marco. His name's really Steve Marguerano, but he's of course, and my father's son, Steve Leon. That was the group.
Yeah, so and I've had T. Morgan on the show because he managed to get a job as a security guard to get in to see the Beatles in Philadelphia. You know, when he was young. So, you know, you have your Philadelphia story, and T. Morgan, another DJ, also managed to get in. So, you know, it that's what makes all of these stories so interesting is how the different stories of, you know, whether you're a fan or whether you're, you know, you had a job working around them. Everybody has experienced, you know, everybody got to experience different. And I always say every story is interesting, and I love hearing them. And I just want to thank you so much.
Before you go, if you're going or whatever's next, I just want to add something here. The idea that you have to be educated there's only one path to get into a given career, still the case. It's always going to be the case that if there's something you aspire to and you can just get your foot in the door, you can get somebody to say hello or offer to go run for coffee or something like that, or just let people know who you are, that you're interested. Sometimes they need somebody to just do something, anything. You know, oh, somebody didn't show up today. You know, I need somebody to answer the phones. I still think that hanging around is an acceptable way to get started in any career. If you find somebody who lets you hang around, I don't think that, you know, we don't have the really formulaic system of apprenticeship and that sort of thing that used to exist. But I don't believe that there'll ever be a case where somebody couldn't just hang around and one day, you know, have that door open. I'm going to put that out there.
Yeah, and you know something? Look at the Beatles scruffs who hung around, you know, Abbey Road Studios, and some of them ended up on recordings as background singers. It can happen, folks. So, anyway, Jay, thank you so much for being on the show and telling us your story. It always makes my day to sit down and talk with somebody and get to hear their story and live these experiences through them. And thank you, listeners, for another. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. It was a lovely interview. And I'm glad there's something in there you can use. Feel free.
You know something? I'm not editing it. It's all come. It's going to be out there now. Your story's out there.
Oh,
Jay.
My God.
Okay.
That's scary. But okay. Nobody knows where I live, so I'm safe. Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. And thank you, listeners, for coming and listening to another episode of I Saw the Beatles. Come back again soon when we'll have another fabulous guest for you to hear about how they saw the Beatles. Take us away, Cliff.